Okay, she said.
Go pack, I said. 3 days. She left, and I asked my sergeant to figure out who was next in line for acting CO. She came back with a name I recognized as the female captain I'd seen in the O Club dining room, the one with a busted arm. I wrote her a note explaining I would be out for 3 days. I told her she was in charge. Then I picked up the phone and called Joe. I'm going to Germany, I said. Okay, he said. Enjoy. Have a safe trip. I can't go to Germany without stopping by Paris on the way back. You know, in the circumstances. He paused. No, he said. I guess you can't. Wouldn't be right not to, I said. But she shouldn't think I care more than you do. That wouldn't be right either. So you should come over, too. When? Take the overnight flight 2 days from now. I'll meet you at Oisy Charles de Gaulle. Then we'll go see her together. Summer met me on the sidewalk outside my quarters, and we carried our bags to the Chevy. We were both in BDUs because we figured our best shot was a night transport out of Andrews Air Force Base. We were too late for a civilian red-eye, and we didn't want to wait all night for the breakfast flights. We got in the car and logged out at the gate. Summer was driving, of course. She accelerated hard and then dropped into a smooth rhythm that was about 10 miles an hour faster than the other cars headed our way. I sat back and watched the road, watched the shoulders and the strip malls and the traffic. We drove north 30 miles and passed by Kramer's Motel, hit the Cloverleaf and jogged east to I-95, headed north. We passed the rest area, passed the spot a mile later where the briefcase had been found. I closed my eyes. I slept all the way to Andrews. We got there well after midnight. We parked in a restricted lot and swapped two of our travel vouchers for two places on a Transportation Corps C-130 that was leaving for Frankfurt at 3 in the morning. We waited in a lounge that had fluorescent lighting and vinyl benches and was filled with the usual ragtag bunch of transients. The military's always on the move. There are always people going somewhere, any time of the night or day. Nobody talked. Nobody ever did. We all just sat there, stiff and tired and uncomfortable. The loadmaster came to get us 30 minutes before takeoff. We filed out onto the tarmac and walked up the ramp into the belly of the plane. There was a long line of cargo pallets in the center bay. We sat on webbing jump seats with our backs to the fuselage wall. On the whole, I figured I preferred the first-class section on Air France. The Transportation Corps doesn't have stewardesses, and it doesn't brew in-flight coffee. We took off a little late, heading west into the wind. Then we turned a slow 180 over D.C. and struck out east. I felt the movement. There were no windows, but I knew we were above the city. Joe was down there somewhere, sleeping. The fuselage wall was very cold at altitude, so we all leaned forward with our elbows on our knees. It was too noisy to talk. I stared at a pallet of tank ammunition until my vision blurred and I fell back to sleep. It wasn't comfortable, but one thing you learn in the Army is how to sleep anywhere. I woke up maybe 10 times, and spent most of the trip in a state of suspended animation. The roar of the engines and the rush of the slipstream helped induce it. It was relatively restful. It was about 60% as good as being in bed. We were in the air nearly 8 hours before we started our initial descent. There was no intercom, no cheery message from the pilot. Just a change in the engine note and a downward lurching movement and a sharp sensation in the ears. All around me, people were standing up and stretching. Summer had her back flat against an ammunition crate, rubbing like a cat. She looked pretty good. Her hair was too short to get messy, and her eyes were bright. She looked determined, like she knew she was heading for doom or glory and was resigned to not knowing which. We all sat down again and held tight to the webbing for the landing. The wheels touched down and the reverse thrust howled and the brakes jammed on tight. The pallets jerked forward against their straps. Then the engines cut back and we taxied a long way and stopped. The ramp came down and a dim dusk sky showed through the hole. It was 5 o'clock in the afternoon in Germany, 6 hours ahead of the East Coast, 1 hour ahead of Zulu time. I was starving. I'd eaten nothing since the burger in Sperryville the previous day. Summer and I stood up and grabbed our bags and got in line, shuffled down the ramp with the others, and out onto the tarmac. The weather was cold. It felt pretty much the same as North Carolina. We were way out in the restricted military corner of the Frankfurt Airport. We took a personnel bus to the public terminal. After that, we were on our own. Some of the other guys had transport waiting, but we didn't. We joined a bunch of civilians in the taxi line, shuffled up, one by one. When our turn came, we gave the driver a travel voucher and told him to drive us east to 12 Corps. He was happy enough to comply. He could swap the voucher for hard currency at any U.S. post, and I was certain he would pick up a couple of 12 Corps guys going out into Frankfurt for a night on the town. No deadheading. No empty running. He was making a living off the U.S. Army, just like plenty of Germans had for 4.5 decades. He was driving a Mercedes-Benz. The trip took 30 minutes. We drove east through suburbs. They looked like a lot of West German places. There were vast tracts of pale honey buildings built back in the '50s. The new neighborhoods ran west to east in random curving shapes, following the routes the bombers had followed. No nation ever lost a war the way Germany lost. Like everyone, I'd seen the pictures taken in 1945. Defeat was not a big enough word. Armageddon would be better. The whole country had been smashed to powdered rubble by a juggernaut. The evidence would be there for all time, written in the architecture, and under the architecture. Every time a phone company dug a trench for a cable, they found skulls and bones and teacups and shells and rusted-out Panzerfausts. Every time ground was broken for a new foundation, a priest was standing by before the steam shovels took their first bite. I was born in Berlin, surrounded by Americans, surrounded by whole square miles of patched-up devastation. "They started it," we used to say. The suburban streets were neat and clean. There were discreet stores with apartments above them. The store windows were full of shiny items. Street signs were black on white, written in an archaic script that made them hard to read. There were small U.S. Army road signs here and there, too. You couldn't go very far without seeing one. We followed the 12 Corps arrows, getting closer all the time. We left the built-up area and drove through a couple of kilometers of farmland. It felt like a moat, like insulation. The eastern sky ahead of us was dark. 12 Corps was based in a typical Glory Days installation. Some Nazi industrialist had built a 1,000-acre factory site out in the fields back in the 1930s. It had featured an impressive home office building and ranks of low metal sheds stretching hundreds of meters behind it. The sheds had been bombed to twisted shards over and over again. The home office building had been only partially damaged. Some weary U.S. Army armored division had set up camp in it in 1945. Thin Frankfurt women in headscarves and faded print dresses had been brought in to pile the rubble in exchange for food. They worked with wheelbarrows and shovels. Then the Army Corps of Engineers had fixed up the office building and bulldozed the piles of rubble away. Successive huge waves of Pentagon spending had rolled in. By 1953, the place was a flagship installation. There was cleaned brick and shining white paint and a strong perimeter fence. There were flagpoles and sentry boxes and guard shacks. There were mess halls and a medical clinic and a PX. There were barracks and workshops and warehouses. Above all, there was 1,000 acres of flat land, and by 1953, it was covered with American tanks. They were all lined up, facing east, ready to roll out and fight for the Fulda Gap. When we got there 37 years later, it was too dark to see much, but I knew that nothing fundamental would have changed. The tanks would be different, but that would be all. The M4 Shermans that had won World War II were long gone, except for two fine examples standing preserved outside the main gate, one on each side, like symbols. They were placed halfway up landscaped concrete ramps, noses high, tails low, like they were still in motion, breasting a rise. They were lit up theatrically. They were beautifully painted, glossy green, with bright white stars on their sides. They looked much better than they had originally. Behind them was a long driveway with white-painted curbs and the floodlit front of the office building, which was now the post headquarters. Behind that would be the tank loggers, with M1A1 Abrams main battle tanks lined up shoulder to shoulder, hundreds of them, at nearly $4 million apiece. We got out of the taxi and crossed the sidewalk and headed for the main gate guard shack. My special unit badge got us past it. It would get us past any U.S. Army checkpoint anywhere, except the inner ring of the Pentagon. We carried our bags down the driveway.
Been here before?
Summer asked me. I shook my head as I walked. I've been in Heidelberg with the infantry, I said, many times.
Is that near?
Not far, I said. There were broad stone steps leading up to the doors. The whole place looked like a capitol building in some small state back home. It was immaculately maintained. We went up the steps and inside. There was a soldier at a desk just behind the doors. Not an MP, just a 12-corps office grunt. We showed him our IDs. Your VOQ got space for us? I asked.
Sir, no problem, he said.
Two rooms, I said, one night.
I'll call ahead, he said. Just follow the signs.
He pointed to the back of the hallway. There were more doors there that would lead out into the complex. I checked my watch. It said noon exactly. It was still set to East Coast time. 6 PM in West Germany. Already dark. I need to see your MPXO, I said. Is he still in his office? The guy used his phone and got an answer. Pointed us up a broad staircase to the second floor.
On your right, he said.
We went up the stairs and turned right. There was a long corridor with offices on both sides. They had hardwood doors with reeded glass windows. We found the one we wanted and went in. It was an outer chamber with a sergeant in it. It was pretty much identical to the one back at Bird. Same paint, same floor, same furniture, same temperature, same smell. Same coffee, and the same standard-issue machine. The sergeant was like plenty I'd seen before, too. Calm, efficient, stoic, ready to believe he ran the place all by himself, which he probably did. He was behind his desk, and he looked up at us as we came in. Spent half a second deciding who we were and what we wanted.
I guess you need Major, he said.
I nodded. He picked up his phone and buzzed through to the inner office.
Go straight through, he said.
We went in through the inner door, and I saw a desk with a guy called Swan behind it. I knew Swan pretty well. Last time I'd seen him was in the Philippines, 3 months earlier, when he was starting a tour of duty that was scheduled to last a year. Don't tell me, I said. You got here December 29th.
Froze my ass off, he said. All I had was Pacific gear. Took 12 Corps 3 days to find me a winter uniform.
I wasn't surprised. Swan was short and wide, almost cubic. He probably owned a percentile all his own on the quartermaster's charts. You're Provost Marshal here, I said. He shook his head.
Temporarily reassigned.
Garber signed your orders?
Allegedly.
Figured it out yet?
Not even close.
Me either, I said. He shrugged like he was saying, Hey, the Army, what can you do?
This is Lieutenant Summer, I said. Special unit?
Swan said. Summer shook her head. But she's cool, I said. Swan stretched a short arm over his desk and they shook hands. I need to see a guy named Marshall, I said. A major. Some kind of 12 Corps staffer.
Is he in trouble?
Someone is. I'm hoping Marshall will help me figure out who. You know him?
Never heard of him, Swan said. I only just got here.
I know, I said. December 29th. He smiled and gave me the what-can-you-do shrug again and picked up his phone. I heard him ask his sergeant to find Marshall and tell him I wanted to see him at his convenience. I looked around while we waited for the response. Swan's office looked borrowed and temporary, just like mine did back in North Carolina. It had the same kind of clock on the wall. Electric, no second hand, no tick. It said 10 minutes past 6:00.